colored her words. I am a luckless woman. My answer came out of me with the assurance of the Great Mother herself, a voice that came through me but not from me. He will be born whole, and soon, if not tonight, then tomorrow. Call me, and I will help you upon the bricks and cut the cord. Ahuri was her name, and after we filled our jars, she led me back to the baker's house. She lived only a few doorways east of Mena, and when her time came the following night, her husband came seeking the foreign-born midwife. With merit, I attended as easy and straightforward a birth as any I ever saw. Ahuri sobbed with relief as she held the third child of her womb, but the only one born breathing. It was a strapping boy she called Din Uri, the first to be named in my honor. Her husband, a potter, gave me a beautiful jar in thanks and kissed my hands, and would have carried me home in his arms had I permitted it. Merit spread the story that I had performed some sort of wonder for Ahuri, and soon we were busier than we had been in Thebes. Most of the men who worked the valley were young, with wives of bearing age, and we attended as many as 10 births in a month. Shifre no longer had idle guests to feed, and indeed, quickly gained more dainties and extra linen than she knew what to do with. Mena was proud to have such respected women under his roof, and treated me like his own aunt. Weeks and months passed quickly, and life in the valley took on its own orderly pace. Mornings were the busiest times, before the great heat descended. The men left early, and children played in the streets while the women swept out their homes, cooked the day's meals, and fetched water at the fountains, where news was exchanged and plans laid for the next festival. While the great river was not visible from the town, it still ruled the ebb and flow of daily life in the arid valley. Its seasons were celebrated in high spirits by the craftsmen, who grew up imbibing the rhythms of farming by the Nile. After so many years in the land of the great river, I finally learned the beautiful names of its seasons. Akit, the inundation. Perit, the going out. Shemu, the harvest. Each had its own holiday and lunar rite, its own festive foods and songs. Just before my first harvest moon in the valley, a scribe came to Mena's door with a letter from my son. Ramos wrote to say that he was living in Thebes again, assigned a scribe to a new vizier called Zafnat Panaak, the king's choice. He sent greetings in the names of Amun-Re and Isis, and a prayer for my good health. It was a formal note, but I was happy that he thought of me enough to send it. And that shard of limestone, written in his own hand, became my most prized possession, and regardless of my protests, became proof of my status as a person of importance. Not long after my son's letter arrived, another man appeared at the door, seeking the woman named Diner. Shifre asked him if it was his wife or his daughter who had need of a midwife's bricks, but he said, neither. Then she asked if he was a scribe with another letter from Thebes, but he said, no, I am a carpenter. Shifre came to the garden with curious news about a bachelor carpenter who sought a midwife. Merit looked up from her spinning sharply, and with a great show of disinterest said, Diner, go and see what the stranger wants. I went without thinking. His eyes were sadder, but in all other ways, he was the same. I stood for only a moment before Benia reached out to me with his right hand. Without hesitation, I placed my left hand in it. I extended my right hand, and he took it with his left. We stood like that, hand in hand, and smiling like fools without speaking, until Merit could stand the suspense no longer. "Oh, Diner," she called with false concern. "Are you there, or was that a pirate at the door?" I led him back through the house to where Merit hopped like a bird from one foot to the other, wearing the wild grin of the god Bess. Shifre smiled, too. having just learned how Merritt had spent the past months seeking out the artist who had offered me his heart along with the luxurious box that accompanied me from Thebes. They bade him sit and offered beer and bread. But Benia looked only at me, and I returned his gaze. "Go ahead, then," Merritt said, giving me a hug and then a push. "Mena will bring your box to you in the morning, and I will follow him with bread and salt. Go, in the name of the Lady Isis and her consort Osiris. Go, and be content." Leaving my friend's house to follow a stranger, I was surprised by my own certainty, but I did not hesitate. We walked through the streets, side by side, for what seemed like a very long time, saying nothing. His house was near the edge of the settlement, close to the path leading up to the tombs, many streets away from Merritt. As we walked, I recalled my mother's stories about hennaed hands and songs for the groom and bride on their way to the bridal tent. I smiled to think of myself as being in a kind of procession at that moment, walking toward my own marriage bed. I smiled, too, to think of how Merritt would rush from fountain to fountain the next morning, telling everyone about the love affair between Benia, the master carpenter, and Diener, the magical midwife. I nearly laughed at the thought. Benia heard the sound that escaped from my mouth as distress. He put his arm around me, placed his lips to my ear, and whispered, "Fear not." Magic words. I laid my head on his shoulder, and we walked the rest of the way holding hands like children. When we arrived at his house, which was nearly as large as Mena's, he took me through the rooms and with great pride showed me the furniture he had built. Two throne-like chairs, an ornately carved bed, boxes in many shapes. I laughed when I saw the easing stool, which was far too beautiful for its foul purpose. "I thought of you when I made these things," he said, shrugging in embarrassment. "I thought of you sitting here, sleeping here, putting things to right in your own way. When Merritt found me, I made this for you." He took an exquisite little box from a niche in the wall. It was unadorned, but perfect, made of ebony, wood that was used almost exclusively for the tombs of kings, and it had been burnished until it shone like a black moon. "For your midwife's kit," he said, and held it out to me. I stared at it for a moment, overwhelmed by his generosity and tenderness. "I have nothing to give you by way of a token," I said. He shrugged with one shoulder, in a gesture I soon came to know as well as I knew my own hands. "You don't have to give me anything. If you take this from my hands freely, your choice will be your token." Thus I became a married woman in Egypt. Benia laid out a meal of bread and onions and fruit for us, and we sat in the kitchen and ate and drank in nervous silence. I had been a girl the last time I had lain with a man. Benia had been thinking of me since that day in the market 2 years earlier. We were shy as two virgins who had been matched by their parents. After we ate, he took my hand and led me to the main hall, where the fine bed stood, piled with clean linen. It reminded me of Raynefer's bed in Nakhre's house. It reminded me of Shalem's bed in his father's house. But then, Benia turned me toward him and put his hands on my face, and I forgot every bed I had ever seen before that moment. Lying together was a tender surprise. From our very first night, Benia took great care of my pleasure and seemed to discover his own in mine. My shyness vanished in the course of that night, and as the weeks passed, I found wells of desire and passion that I had never suspected in myself. When Benia lay with me, the past vanished, and I was a new soul, reborn in the taste of his mouth, the touch of his fingers. His huge hands cupped my body and untied secret knots created by years of loneliness and silence. The sight of his naked legs, thick and ropey with sinew, aroused me so much that Benia would tease me as he left in the morning, lifting his skirt to reveal the top of his thigh, making me blush and laugh. My husband went to his workshop every morning, but unlike the stonecutters and painters, he did not have to work in the tombs, so he returned to me in the evening, where he and I discovered greater pleasure in each other, and the sorry fact that I did not know how to cook. During my years in Noctre's house, I rarely strayed into the kitchen, much less prepared a meal. I had never learned how to make bread in an Egyptian oven, or to gut fish or pluck fowl. We ate unripe fruit from Benia's neglected garden, and I begged bread from Mena. Shamefaced, I asked Shifre for a cooking lesson, which Merit attended only to tease me. I tried to recreate my mother's recipes, but I lacked the ingredients, and I forgot the proportions. I felt sheepish and ashamed, but Benia only laughed. "We won't starve," he said. "I have kept myself alive for years on borrowed bread and fruit, and the occasional feast at the house of my fellows and family. I did not marry you to be my cook." But while I was a stranger in the kitchen, I found great joy in keeping my own house. There was such sweetness in deciding where to place a chair and in choosing what to plant in the garden. I relished creating my own order, and hummed whenever I swept the floor or folded blankets. I spent hours arranging pots in the kitchen, first in order of size, then according to color. My house was a world of my own possession, a country in which I was ruler and citizen, where I chose and where I served. One night, when I returned home very late, exhausted after attending at the birth of healthy twins, I thought I had lost my way. Standing in the middle of the street in the dead of night, I recognized my home by its smell, a mixture of coriander, clover, and Benia's cedary scent. A few months after I moved to my own house, Mena prepared a small banquet for me and Benia. My husband's workmen sang songs of their workshop. Merit's sons sang of bread. And then all the men, together with their wives and children, joined voices for love songs, of which there seemed to be an endless number. I was bashful at the attention showered upon us, the cups raised, the broad smiles and kisses. Even though Benia and I were really too old for such nonsense, we were giddy with delight in each other. When Merit leaned over and told me to stop grudging people the chance to bask in the light of our shared happiness, I put aside all shyness in gratitude and smiled into the faces of my friends. I had been right to trust Benia, who was the soul of kindness. One night we lay on our backs staring up at the heavens. There was only a sliver of moon, and the stars danced above, when he told me his life. His words came slowly, for many of the memories were sad ones. "I have only one memory of my father," said Benia, "the sight of his back, which I saw as he walked away from me in a field where I sat behind the plow, breaking up clods. I was 6 years old when he died, leaving Ma with four children. I was the third son. She had no brothers, and my father's people were not generous. She had to find places for us, so my mother took me to the city and showed my hands to the stonecutters. They took me on as an apprentice and taught me and worked me until my back was strong and my hands calloused. But I became a joke in the workshops. Marble would crack if I walked into a room, and granite would weep if I raised a chisel to it. Wandering in the market one day, I watched as a carpenter repaired an old stool for a poor woman. He saw my belt and bowed low, for even though I was only an apprentice, stonecutters who work in immortal materials are considered far greater than woodworkers, whose greatest achievements decay like a man's body. I told the carpenter that his respect was misplaced and that mere sandstone defeated me. I confessed that I was in danger of being turned into the street. The woodworker took my hand in his, turning it this way and that. He handed me a knife and a scrap of wood, and asked me to carve a toy for his grandson. The wood seemed warm and alive, and a doll took shape in my hands without effort. The very grain of the pine seemed to smile at me. The carpenter nodded at the thing I made and took me to the workshop of his teacher, presenting me as a likely apprentice. And there I discovered my life's work. Here my husband sighed. There, too, I met my wife, who was a servant in the house of my master. "We were so young," he said softly. And in the silence that followed, I understood that he had loved the wife of his youth with his whole heart. After a long pause, he said, "We had two sons." Again he stopped, and in the silence I heard the voices of little boys, Benny's doting laughter, a woman singing a lullaby. "They died of river fever," Benny said. "I had taken them from the city to see my brother, who had married into a farming family. But when we arrived at the house, we found my brother dying and the rest of his family stricken. My wife cared for them all," he whispered. "We should have left," he said, with self-reproach still raw after many years. "After that," he said, "I lived only in my work and loved only my work. I visited the prostitutes once," he confessed sheepishly, "but they were too sad. Until the day I saw you in the marketplace, I did not bother to hope for anything. When I first recognized you as my beloved, my heart came to life," he said. "But when you disappeared and seemed to scorn me, I grew angry. For the first time in my life, I raged against heaven for stealing my family, and then for dangling you before my eyes and snatching you away. I was furious and frightened of my own loneliness. So I took a wife." I had been perfectly still until then, but that announcement made me sit up. "Yes, yes," he said, embarrassed. "My sister found me a marriageable girl, a servant in the house of a painter, and I brought her here with me. It was a disaster. I was too old for her. She was too silly for me." "Oh, Diener," he said, in a misery of apology. "We were so mismatched it could have been funny. We never spoke. We tried sharing my bed twice, and even that was awful. Finally, she was braver than I, poor girl. After 2 weeks, she left. Walked out of the house while I was at work, down to the ferry and back to the painter's house, where she remains. I was resigned to making strong drink my regular companion, until Merritt sought me out. She visited me 3 times before I would agree to see you. I am lucky that your friend does not understand the meaning of no." I turned to my husband and said, "And my luck is measured by your kindness, which is boundless." We made love very slowly that night, as though for the last time, weeping. One of his tears fell in my mouth, where it became a blue sapphire, source of strength and eternal hope. Benia did not ask for my story in return. His eyes would fill with questions when I mentioned my mother's way of making beer, or my aunt's skill as a midwife, but he stepped back from his need to know. I think he feared that I might vanish if he so much as asked me the meaning of my name or the word for water in my native tongue. On another moonless night, I told him as much of my truth as I could, that Ramos's father was the son of Rhaenefer, sister of Noctre, and that I came to Thebes after the murder of my husband in our own bed. When he heard that, Benny has shuddered, took me into his arms as though I was a child, and stroked my hair, and said nothing but, "Poor thing," which was everything I had longed to hear. Neither of us ever gave voice to the names of our beloved dead ones, and for this act of respect, they permitted us to live in peace with our new mates, and never haunted our thoughts by day or visited our dreams at night. Life was sweet in the Valley of the Kings, on the west bank of the river. Benia and I had everything we needed in each other. Indeed, we were rich in all ways but one, for we lacked children. I was barren, or perhaps only too old to bear. Although I had already lived a full life, close to 20 years, my back was strong and my body still obeyed the pull of the moon. I was certain that my womb was cold, but even so, I could never root out all hope from my heart, and I grieved with the flux of every new moon. Still, we were not completely childless, for Merritt often sat in our doorstep, trailing her grandchildren, who treated us as uncle and aunt, especially little Kia, who liked to sleep in our house so much that her mother sometimes sent her to stay with us, to help me in the garden and to brighten our days. Benia and I shared stories in the evenings. I told him of the babies that I caught, and of the mothers who died, though they were blessedly few. He spoke of his commissions, each one a new challenge, based not only upon the desires of the buyer and builders, but also upon the wishes of the wood in his hand. The days passed peacefully, and the fact that there was little to mark one from the next seemed a great gift to me. I had Benia's hands, Merritt's friendship, the feel of newborn flesh, the smiles of new mothers, a little girl who laughed in my kitchen, a house of my own. It was more than enough. Chapter 4. I knew about Ramos's message even before the messenger arrived at my house. Kia ran to the door with the news that a scribe had come to Mena's house, seeking Dinar, the midwife, and was on his way to Benia's door. I was delighted at the prospect of another letter from my son. It had been more than a year since the last one, and I imagined myself showing Benia my son's own writing on the limestone tablet when he arrived home that evening. I stood in the doorway, anxious to discover the contents of this letter. But when the man turned the corner, surrounded by a pack of excited little children, I realized that the messenger brought his own message. Ramos and I stared at each other. I saw a man I did not know, the image of Noctre, except for his eyes, which were set like his father's. I saw nothing of myself in the Prince of Egypt, who stood before me, dressed in fine linen, with a gold pectoral gleaming on his chest and new sandals on his manicured feet. I did not know what he saw as he looked at me. I thought I detected disdain in his eye, but perhaps that was only my own fear. I wondered if he could see that I stood taller now that I carried less grief on my back. Whatever he saw or thought, we were strangers. "Forgive my manners," I said finally. "Come inside the house of Benia, and let me give you some cool beer and fruit. I know the journey from Thebes is dusty." Ramos recovered too, and said, "Forgive me, mother. It is so long since I saw your dear face." His words were cool, and his embrace a quick, awkward hug. "I would gladly take a drink," he said, and followed me into the house. I saw each room through his eyes, which were accustomed to the spacious beauties of palaces and temples. The front room, my room, which I treasured for the colorful wall painting, suddenly looked small and bare, and I was glad when he hurried through it. Benia's hall was larger, and furnished with pieces seen only in great houses and tombs. The quality of the chairs and bed found approval in my son's eyes, and I left him there to fetch food and drink. Kia had followed us in and stared at the beautifully dressed man in my house. "Is this my sister?" asked Ramos, pointing to the silent child. "No," I said. "This is the niece of a friend, and like a niece to me." My answer seemed to relieve him. "The gods seem to have ordained that you remain my only child," I added. "I am glad to see you healthy and successful. Tell me, Are you married yet? Am I a grandmother? No, said Ramos. My duties keep me too busy for my own family, he said, with a tight little wave of his hand. Perhaps some day my situation will improve, and I can give you little ones to dandle on your knee. But this was nothing more than polite conversation, which hung in the air and smelled of falsehood. The gulf between us was far too wide for any such familiarity. If and when I became a grandmother, I would know my grandchildren only through messages sent on limestone slabs, meant to be discarded after they are read. Ma, he said after drinking from his cup, I am here not only for my own pleasure. My master sends me to fetch the finest midwife in Egypt to attend his wife's labor. No, it is true, he said, dismissing my shrug. Say nothing to diminish your repute, for no one has taken your place in Thebes. The lady of my master has miscarried twice, and nearly died from a stillbirth. The physicians and necromancers have done her no good, and now the midwives fear to attend a princess who has had so much bad luck in childbed. Her own mother is dead, and she is afraid. My master dotes on this wife, and wishes nothing more than to have sons by her. Asnat heard of your skills from her servants, and asked her husband to search out the foreign-born woman with the golden hands who once served the women of Thebes. My lord depends upon me for all things, and called upon me in this matter as well, said Ramos, his mouth growing smaller and more pursed at every mention of his master. Imagine my surprise when I learned that he sought none but my own mother. He was suddenly impressed by my lineage when he learned that you were a countryman of his, Ramos added ironically. The vizier charged me to put aside duties of state, to walk into the Valley of the Kings and accompany you to his house. He ordered me not to return without you. You do not like this man, I said mildly. Zafnat Panaach is vizier in Thebes at the king's pleasure, said my son, in formal but damning tones. He is said to be a great diviner who sees into the future and reads dreams as easily as a master scribe perusing the glyphs of a schoolboy. But he is illiterate, said Ramos bitterly. He cannot cipher or write or read, which is why the king assigned me, the best of Carr's students, to be his right hand. And that is where I am now, wifeless, childless, second to a barbarian. I stiffened at the word. Ramos noticed my reaction and colored in shame. Oh, Ma, not you, he said quickly. You are not like the rest of them, or else my father and grandmother would never have chosen you. You are fine, he said. There is no mother in Egypt better than you. His flattery made me smile in spite of myself. He embraced me, and for a moment, I regained the loving boy who had been my son. We drank our beer in silence for a moment. Then I said, "Of course I will follow you to Thebes. If the king's vizier commands you to bring me, I will come. But first, I must speak with my friend, Merit, who is my right hand in the birth chamber and should come with me. I must talk with my husband, Benia, the master carpenter, so that he knows where I go and when I might return." Ramos pursed his lips again. "There is no time for this, Ma. We must leave now, for the lady is in travail and my lord expects me every hour. Send the girl here to inform the others. I cannot tarry." "I'm afraid you must," I said, and I left the room. Ramos followed me to the kitchen and grabbed me by the elbow, like a master about to strike a disobedient servant. I pulled away and looked into his face. Noctre would sooner die than treat a relative, much less a mother, in this fashion. "Is this how you honor the memory of the only father you ever knew? I remember him as a noble man to whom you owe everything and whose name you dishonor." Ramos stopped and hung his head. His ambition and his heart were at war, and his face showed the division in his soul. He fell to the ground and bowed low, his brow at my feet. "I forgive you," I said. "It will only take me a moment to prepare, and we will find my friend and husband on our path to Thebes." Ramos raised himself from the ground again and waited outside, while I prepared for a journey I hated to make. As I gathered my kit and a few herbs, I smiled at my own brazenness, shaming my powerful son for his rudeness, insisting on my farewells. Where was the meek woman who lived in Noctre's house all those years? Merritt waited for me at her son's door, hungry for the news. Her eyes grew large when I introduced her to Ramos, whom she had not seen since he was a boy. She covered her mouth in awe at the invitation to wait upon the wife of the king's vizier, but Merritt could not accompany me. Three women in the town were due to give birth at any moment, and one of them was Kin, the daughter of Shifre's brother. We embraced, and she wished me the touch of Isis and the luck of Bess. She stood at her door and waved gaily. "Bring me back some good stories," she shouted, and her laughter followed me down the street. Benia did not send me away with laughter. He and my son looked at each other coolly. Benia dipped his head in recognition of the scribe's position, and Ramos nodded at the carpenter's authority over so important a workshop. There was no way for my husband and me to take a proper leave of each other. We exchanged our parting vows with our eyes. I would return. He would not be content until I did. Ramos and I walked out of the valley, saying little to each other. Before we began the descent from the valley to the riverbank, I put my hand on his arm, signaling him to stop. Turning to face home, I dropped a twist of rue from my garden and a piece of bread from my oven to ensure a speedy return. It was dark by the time we reached the river, but we had no need to wait for the morning ferry. The king's bark, lit with 100 lamps, waited for us. Many oars rowed us, and in no time we were hurrying through the sleeping streets of the city and into the great palace, where Ramos left me at the door to the women's quarters. I was taken to a chamber where a pale young woman sat perched on her great bed, alone. "You are Diener?" she asked. "Yes, Asnat," I replied gently, placing my bricks on the floor. "Let me see what the gods have in store for us." "I fear this one is dead too," she whispered, "and if it is so, let me die with him." I put my ear to her belly and touched the womb. "This baby is alive," I said. "Fear not, he is just resting for the journey." At daylight, her pains began in earnest. Asnat tried to be quiet, as befits a royal lady, but nature had made her a screamer, and she soon filled the air with roars at every pang. I called for fresh water to bathe the mother's face, for fresh straw, for lotus cones to freshen the room, and for five serving women who gathered around their mistress to offer encouragement. Sometimes it is easier for the poor, I thought. Even those without family live in such close quarters to their neighbors that the cries of a laboring mother bring out other women, like geese responding to the call of a leader in flight. But the rich are surrounded by servants too fearful of their mistresses to act as sisters. Asnat did not have an easy time, but it was nowhere near the worst labor I'd seen. She pushed for long hours, supported by women who became her sisters, at least for that day. Just after sunset, she produced a skinny but healthy son, who roared for the breast as soon as he was held upright. Asnat kissed my hands, covering them with joyful tears, and sent one of her servants to tell Zafnat Paneach that he was the father of a fine son. I was taken to a quiet room, where I fell into a dark, dreamless sleep. I awoke the following morning, drenched in sweat, my head throbbing, my throat on fire. Lying on the pallet, I squinted at the light pouring through the high windows and tried to remember the last time I had been ill. My head pounded, and I closed my eyes again. When next they opened, the light was draining from the room. A girl sitting by the wall noticed I was awake and brought me a drink and placed a cool towel on my brow. 2 days passed, or maybe it was three, in a blur of fevered sleep and compresses. When my head finally cooled and the pain subsided, I found myself too weak to stand. By then, a woman called Sherry had been sent to attend me. I stared with an open mouth when she introduced herself, for her name, which means little one, sat oddly upon the fattest woman I'd ever seen. Sherry washed the sour smell from my body and brought me broth and fruit and offered to fetch anything else I might wish. I had never been waited upon like that, and while I did not enjoy her hovering over me, I was grateful for her help. After a few days, my strength began to return, and I asked Sherry to tell me the news of the baby I had delivered. She was delighted by my question and settled her weight about her on a stool, for Sherry loved an audience. "The baby was well," she reported. "He is ravenous and has nearly worn off his mother's nipples with constant feeding," said Sherry with a wicked grin. She had pitied her mistress's childlessness, but found us not an arrogant snip of a mistress. "Motherhood will teach her everything," my new friend confided. "The father has named the boy Menashe, an awful name that must mean something fine in his native tongue. Menashe, it sounds like chewing, does it not? But you are of Canaan as well, are you not?" I shrugged. "It was so long ago," I said. "Please continue with the story, Sherry. It is almost magical, the way your words make me forget my aches and pains." She gave me a sharp look to let me know that flattery did not hide my reticence, but she continued anyway. "Tsafna Paniak is truly an arrogant son of a bitch," she said, proving her trust in me by swearing about the master. "He likes to talk of his lowly beginnings as though this makes his powerful position even greater due to his rise. But this is no great thing in Egypt. Many great men, statesmen and craftsmen, warriors and artisans, are born of the lowly. Such is the case with your own husband, eh, Diener?" she asked, letting me know that my history was not entirely closed to her. But I only smiled. "The Canaanite is handsome, no doubt about that. Women swoon at the sight of him, or at least they did when he was younger. Men are drawn to him as well, and not only the ones who prefer boys. Of course, that beauty did not serve him well when he was young. His own brothers hated him so much, they sold him to a pack of slavers. Can you imagine an Egyptian doing such a thing? Every day I thank the gods that I was born in the valley of the great river." "No doubt," I said, surveying her girth, for there was no other land that could support such excess. Sherry caught my meaning and grabbed at her midsection with both hands. "Ha-ha! I am a creature of amazing proportions, am I not? The king once pinched me and said that only dwarves pleased him more than the sight of someone as large and round as me." "You would not believe how many men find this desirable," Sherry said. "In my own youth," she began in a conspiratorial whisper, "I gave pleasure to the old king until his wife grew jealous and had me packed off to Thebes. But that," she winked, "is another story for another time. You want the history of this house, which is juicy enough," she confided. Tsafna Paniak was sold into slavery, as I said, and his new masters were swine, the most Canaanite of the Canaanites. I don't doubt that he was beaten and raped and forced to do the dirtiest work. Of course, His Majesty does not speak of that anymore. Tsafna Paniak did not acquire that pompous name until recently. The god speaks and he lives, indeed. They used to call him Stick, for when he first came to Egypt, he was as skinny as his newborn son. When his owners came to Thebes, he was sold to Potiphar, a palace guard with sticky fingers who lived in a great house on the outskirts of the city. Because Stick was more clever than his master by half, he was put in charge of the garden and then given oversight of the wine pressing. Finally, he was set above the other servants in the house, for Potiphar loved the Canaanite boy and used him for his own pleasure. But Potiphar's wife, a great beauty called Nebetper, also looked upon him with longing, and the two of them became lovers right under the master's nose. There is even some gossip about who fathered her last daughter. In any case, Potiphar finally discovered them in bed together, and he could no longer pretend not to know what was going on. So in a great show of anger and vengeance, he sent Stick to prison. By that point, I had lost interest in Sherry's story, which apparently had no end. I wanted to sleep, but there was no stopping the woman, who did not see my hint when I yawned, or even when I closed my eyes. "The Theban jail is no laughing matter," she said darkly. "A hideous pit, where men die of murder and despair as much as fever, full of madmen and cutthroats. But the warden came to pity his handsome inmate, who was neither hateful nor insane. Soon he was taking his meals with a Canaanite, who spoke a good Egyptian by then. The warden was a bachelor and childless, and he treated Stick like a son. As the years passed, he gave Stick responsibility for his fellows, until finally he was the one to determine which man slept near a window and which man was chained close to the latrine, so the inmates did what they could to bribe and please him. "I tell you, Diener," Sherry said, shaking her head in admiration, "wherever this fellow goes, power seems to move into his hands." Meanwhile, the old king died, and the new king had a habit of punishing minor offenses against him by sending people to jail. If he was displeased by the texture of his bread at dinner, he might send the baker to jail for a week or even longer. Cupbearers, wine stewards, sandal makers, even captains of the guard were sent to languish in that place, where they met Stick. Everyone was struck by his princely bearing and by his ability to interpret dreams and divine the future. He told one poor drunkard that he would not live out the week, and when he was found dead, not murdered, mind you, simply done in by years of strong drink, the prisoners proclaimed him an oracle. When a cupbearer returned from prison with a story about a jailer who saw into the future, the king sent for Stick and set him to interpret a series of dreams that had plagued him for months. "It was not a difficult dream to divine, if you ask me," said Sherry. "Fat fish being devoured by bony fish, fat cows being trampled by skinny cows, and then 7 fat stalks of wheat which were beaten down, leaving 7 dead stalks. Any half-wit magician who pulls birds from beneath baskets in the marketplace could have interpreted that one," Sherry sniggered. But the dreams haunted and frightened the idiot king, and it calmed him to hear that he had 7 years in which to prepare for the coming famine. And so he elevated the jailer, an unlettered foreign-born conniver, to become his first in command. "I imagine your son has already told you that this so-called Zafnat Paneah is totally dependent upon Ramos. And now that Zafnat is not only vizier, but a father as well, there will be no stopping his pride," Sherry fumed, bustling around the room, preparing my bed, for she had talked away the whole afternoon. "And yesterday," she grumbled, speaking to herself by that point, "this madman demanded that his son be circumcised. Not when he is at manhood's door and able to withstand such a thing, not like civilized people, but now, immediately. Can you imagine wanting to do that to a tiny baby? It only goes to prove that a born barbarian does not change. Asnat screamed and carried on like a gutted cat at the order, and I can't blame her there." "Joseph," I whispered, in horror and disbelief. Sherry peered up at me. "What?" she said. "What did you say, Diener?" But I closed my eyes, suddenly unable to breathe. All at once I understood why I had been summoned to Thebes, and why Sherry had told me the endless story of the vizier. But surely this could not be. It was fever that weakened my reason. Dizzy and light-headed, I lay down on the bed, panting. Sherry noticed that something was amiss with me. "Diener," she said, "are you unwell? Can I get you something? Maybe you are ready for solid food now. But here is something to cheer you up," she said, looking up at the sound of footsteps. "Your son comes to pay respects. Here is Ramos. I will bring you both some refreshment," she burbled, and left me with my son. "Mother," he said, formally, with a stiff bow. But when he saw my face, he started. "Ma, what is it? They told me you were much improved, and that I might see you today," he said doubtfully. but perhaps this is not the right time. I turned my face toward the wall and waved him out of the room. I heard Sherry go out with him and murmur an explanation. His hurried footsteps fading in the distance were the last thing I knew before I fell asleep. Sherry had told Ramos of our conversation and repeated the word I had spoken before falling back into a fevered darkness of mind. Thus my son took Joseph into his mouth and unannounced went into the great hall where the vizier of Egypt sat alone, whispering comfort to his firstborn son, who had been circumcised earlier that day. Joseph, said Ramos, throwing the name at him like a challenge, and the one known as Zaphnat Paneach trembled. Do you know a woman called Diner? He demanded. For a moment Zaphnat Paneach said nothing, and then he asked, Dina? The master looked into his scribe's eyes. I had a sister named Dina, but she died long ago. How do you come by her name? What do you know of Joseph? He commanded. I will tell you what there is to tell after you describe her death, said Ramos, but only then. The threat in his voice rankled Joseph, but even though he sat on a throne with a healthy son in his arms and guards ready to do his bidding, he felt bound to answer. It had been a lifetime since he had heard his own name, 20 years since he had spoken his sister's name aloud. So he began. In a quiet voice that drew Ramos close to the throne, he told him that Dina had gone to the palace in Shechem with his mother, Rachel, the midwife, to tend to a birth in the house. A prince of the city claimed her for a bride, said Joseph, and Ramos heard how Jacob turned away the handsome bride price and finally accepted him only on the cruelest of conditions. Ramos shuddered to learn his father's name from Joseph's lips, but in the next moment he learned that my brothers, his own uncles, had slaughtered Shalem in his own bed. Ramos bit his tongue to keep from crying out. Joseph declared his repugnance for the crime and proclaimed his own innocence. Two of my brothers bloodied their hands, he said, but admitted that perhaps four of them had had some part in the murder. All of us were punished. She cursed us all. Some of my brothers fell ill, others saw their sons die. My father lost all hope, and I was sold into slavery. Joseph said, I used to blame my sister for my misfortunes, but no longer. If I knew where she was buried, I would go and pour libations and build a stele in her memory. At least I survived my brother's villainy, and with the birth of this son, the God of my fathers shows me that I will not die forgotten. But my sister's name was blotted out, as though she had never drawn breath. She was my milk sister, said Joseph, shaking his head. It is strange to speak of her now that I am a father. Perhaps I will name the next one in her honor. And he fell silent. And what is Joseph? Ramos asked. Joseph is the name my mother gave me, said Zaphnat Paneach quietly. Ramos turned to leave, but the vizier called him back. Wait, we have a bargain. Tell me how you came to know my name and the name of my sister. Ramos stopped and without facing him said, She is not dead. The words hung in the air. She is here in your palace. Indeed, you bade her brought here. Diner, the midwife, the one who delivered your son, is your sister, Dina, my mother. Joseph's eyes grew wide in wonder, and he smiled like a happy child, but Ramos spit at his feet. Would you have me call you uncle? He hissed. I hated you from the first. You robbed me of a position that is rightly mine, and you advance in the king's eyes because of my skill. Now I see that you blasted my life from birth. You slaughtered my father in the prime of his youth. You and your barbarian brothers murdered my grandfather too, who, though a Canaanite, acted honorably. You ripped the heart out of my grandmother. You betrayed your sister, widowed my mother, and made me an orphan and an outcast. When I was a boy, My grandmother's servant told me that when I finally found my father's murderers, their names would rip my soul into pieces. His words were true. You are my uncle. Oh, gods, what a nightmare, Ramos cried. A murderer and a liar. How dare you claim innocence in this abomination? Perhaps you raised no sword yourself, but you did nothing to stop them. You must have known something of the plot, you and your father and the rest of his seed. I see the blood of my father on your hands. Your guilt is still in your eyes. Joseph looked away. There is nothing left but for me to kill you or die a coward. If I do not avenge my father, I will be unworthy of this life, much less the next. Ramos's voice, raised in hatred, alerted the guards, who subdued him and led him away, while Menashe wailed in his father's arms. When I finally woke, Sherry sat beside me, her face stricken. What is it? I asked. Oh, lady, she said in a great rush to tell me what she knew. I have bad news. Your son and the vizier have quarreled, and Ramos is under guard in his chambers. The master is said to be furious, and they say that the young scribe is in mortal danger. I do not know the cause of their quarrel, not yet at least, but when I learn it, I will tell you immediately. I got to my feet, wobbling but determined. Sherry, I commanded, listen to me now, for I will not argue or repeat myself. I must speak to the master of the house. Go and announce me. The serving woman bowed from the waist, but in a small voice said, You cannot go to Zafnat Paniak looking as you do. Let me give you a bath and dress your hair. Put on a clean gown, so you can make your case like a lady and not a beggar. I nodded my assent, suddenly frightened by the scene ahead. What words could I use to a brother I had not seen for a lifetime? I crouched in the bath as Sherry poured cool water over me and leaned back as she brushed and arranged my hair. I felt like a slave about to be paraded before a gallery of buyers. When I was ready, Sherry led me to the door of Zafnat Paniak's hall, where he sat with his head in his hands. Dinar, the midwife, requests an audience, she said. The vizier stood up and waved me in. Leave us, he barked. Sherry and all of his retainers disappeared. We were alone. Neither of us moved. We kept our places on opposite ends of the room and stared. Though the years had cost him his smooth cheeks and a few of his teeth, Joseph was still fair of face and strong, still the son of Rachel. Dina, he said. Ahati, little sister, he said, in the language of our youth. The grave has set you free. Yes, Joseph, I said. I am alive, and amazed to be in your presence. But the only reason I come to you is to ask what has become of my son. Your son knows the story of his father's death, and he threatens my life, said Joseph stiffly. He holds me responsible for the sins of my brothers. His threat alone could cause his execution, but because he is your son, I will only send him away. He will not come to harm, I promise, said Joseph kindly. I have recommended that the king give him charge of a prefecture in the north, where he will be second to none. In time, he will fall in love with the sea. They all do. And he will build a life seasoned with salt air and salt water, and not wish for any other. You must tell him to do as I say, and forget this talk of revenge, said Joseph. You must do this now, tonight. If he raises a hand to me, if he so much as threatens me in the company of my guard, he must die. I doubt that my son will listen to my words, I said sadly. He hates me, for I am the cause of his unhappiness. Nonsense, said Joseph, with the supreme self-confidence that made our brother so jealous. The men of Egypt honor their mothers like no other men in the world. You do not know, I said. He called his grandmother Ma. I was no more than his wet nurse. No, Dina, said Joseph. He suffers too much for that to be true. He will listen to you, and he must go. I looked at my brother and saw a man I did not know. I will do as you say, master, I said, in the voice of a good servant, but ask me for nothing else. Let me be free of this place, for it is a tomb to me. Seeing you is like stepping into the past where my sorrow lies. And now, because of you, I lose all hope of my son. Joseph nodded. I understand, Ahati, and it will be as you say, except in one matter. When my wife comes to the bricks again, and I have already dreamed of a second son, you must come and attend her. You may come without seeing me if you like, and you will be well paid. Indeed, you will be paid in land if you wish, you and the carpenter. I bridled at the suggestion that I was a pauper, and announced, My husband, Benia, is master craftsman in the Valley of the Kings. Benia? He asked, and Joseph's face crumbled into regret. That was the baby name for our brother, Benjamin, the last born of my mother, who died giving him life. I used to hate Benia for killing her, but now I think I would give half of what is mine only to hold his hand. I have no desire to see him, I said, surprising both of us with the anger in my voice. I am no longer of that world. If my mothers are dead, then I am an orphan. My brothers are no more to me than the livestock of our youth. You and I were kin as children, when we knew each other well enough to share our hearts. But that was in another life. The great room was silent, each of us lost in memories. I will go to my son, I said finally. Then I will be gone. Go in peace, said Joseph. Ramos lay face down on the bed in his handsome suite. My son did not move, or speak, or show me any sign of recognition. I spoke to his back. His windows overlooked the river, which glittered in the moonlight. Your father loved the river, I said, fighting tears, and you will love the sea. I will not see you again, Ramos, and there will be no other opportunity to speak these words again. Listen to your mother, who comes to say goodbye. I do not ask you to forgive my brothers. I never did. I never will. I ask only that you forgive me for the bad luck of being their sister. Forgive me for never speaking to you of your father. That was your grandmother's command, for she saw secrecy as the only way to keep you from the agony that cuts you low today. She knew that the past could threaten your future, and we must continue to protect you against the accidents of birth. The true story of your parentage is still known only by you, me, and Zafnat Paneach. There is no need to tell anyone else. But now that we share this secret, I will tell you something else. Ramos, your father was called Shalem, and he was as beautiful as the sunset for which he was named. We chose each other in love. The name I gave you at my breast was Bar Shalem, son of the sunset, and your father lived in you. Your grandmother called you Ramos, making you a child of Egypt and the sun god. In either language and in any country, you are blessed by the great power of the heavens. Your future is written on your face, and I pray that you will have the fullness of years denied to your father. May you find contentment. I will remember you in the morning and in the evening, every day until I close my eyes forever. I forgive your every harsh thought of me and the curses you may hurl at my name. And when at last you do forgive me, I forbid you to suffer a moment's guilt in my name. I ask that you remember only